Okay.
Chairperson, it looks like EFF memorabilia in front of you. It should be natural colors, Chair.
Okay. Yes, honorable members, I'm very sorry. Yeah, I will deal with the picture later. As long as you can hear me, I apologize for coming a little bit late because the iPad just slipped out of my hands and fell on the floor, on the tiles, and cracked around 10 to. So I'm very sorry about that. And I was trying to fix it and I couldn't succeed. So please bear with me. We welcome everybody on the platform. South Africans who are joining us on different social media platforms of Parliament. And yourselves, honorable members, you are also welcomed. I also welcome the representatives. We welcome the collective of the representatives of the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. Ambassadors that may be joining us on this platform. In particular, we also welcome our presenter who will be taking us through the situation in Libya. We are going to, before we give Austin Nail an opportunity to do some elaboration on the introduction of our presenter today, we will take apologies. Lubabalo.
Thank you, Chair. We only have three apologies, Chairperson. The minister is attending cabinet. Honorable Mishwe is attending PC on police. Will join the committee at around 11. And then we have another apology from the DG. The DG had bereavement. We have TDG Monyela, who's the acting DG. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Honourable members, any other apology? None. As you know, honourable members, we did indicate that one of the things we'll be doing today here is to understand the political situation that is going on in Libya. As you know, Libya went through some difficult times and now has to prepare for the elections there. So to understand how the situation is unfolding, we then invited a guest who is going to help us through understanding the unfolding situation here. And that guest is the Department of International Relations and cooperation. You heard from the apologies that the acting DG of the department has a bereavement. So what has happened in my discussion with the department this morning is that Dade Munyala will then do the presentation on behalf of the department in an acting capacity which has been designated by the minister in line with the powers that have been delegated to the minister by the President of the Republic. So I will give the department the opportunity then to do the presentation. After the presentation, honorable members, it will be interaction with the presentation. And I hope by then we will have wrapped up everything, where we will talk about the workshop, which is going to happen, the retreat, which is supposed to happen for the portfolio committee to plan for the year. And the ending of this year and the financial year, which is starting 2022-2023. So we'll be looking as to where we come from, the last financial year, which is ending now, and then we'll be looking at 2022-2024.
Dade Munyala. Thank you, Chair. It's Deputy Minister Mashiko Dlamini.
Oh, I wasn't aware that you are here, Deputy Minister. How's things?
No, we're fine, Chair. I just want to do opening remarks then.
Yes. That's the proper way. Sorry, I wasn't aware that you are here. My apologies, my dear comrade, my leader, my sister, my mother.
Thank you.
Over to you then, Deputy Minister.
Thank you very much, Chair, and greetings to yourself and the honourable members of the committee. Chairperson, South Africa foreign policy vision is to achieve an African continent that is peaceful, democratic, non-racial, non-sexist, united, and prosperous, and which contribute to the world that is just and equitable. South Africa pursues this policy vision guided by the African values of Ubuntu. The strategic focus of the department, Chair, is guided by the National Development Plan Vision 2030, as unpacked in the medium-term strategic framework 2019 to 2024, which inter alia is in line with the African Union Agenda 2063, and the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal 2030 agenda. During the execution of South Africa's foreign policy, DECO works to contribute to all 7 MTSF priorities, with a focus of the 7th priority, which is a better Africa and the world. In doing so, the department must contend with an environment that is interlinked with regional, continental, and global developments, including fluctuations and disruptions. South Africa's foreign policy is implemented within a highly dynamic and challenging global environment, which at the time is unpredictable. Our presentation today places South Africa's foreign policy approach with the content of political and electoral developments in Libya. The current global environment is characterized by, among other things, threats of the illegal use of force, transnational organized crime, the displacement of population due to civil conflict, global irregular and illegal immigration due to conflict, poverty and inequality, the rise in populism, tensions over the control of strategic resources and geopolitical influence and trade wars. There has also been an increasing trend towards unilateralism, protectionism, nationalism, populism, and an inward-looking focus on countries' domestic priorities. Strong tendencies to pursue national interest and the fragmentation of global decision-making are emerging. Multilateralism, which is under threat, remains a focus point of South Africa's foreign policy, and engagement are premised on the need to advance the development priorities of developing countries by influencing multilateral process. The Libyan case suggests that conflict resolution is still relies on the UN or regional peacekeepers to bring about stability, and that an ownership-based process led and driven Libyans themselves remain a distant reality. The Libyan case also suggests that instability often involves foreign interest and a race to influence, conquer, or even secure natural resources from African continent. Similarly, military maneuvers to those that play out in the Syrian conflict appears evident in Libya. To promote peace, security, and stability on the continent, South Africa uses its simultaneous presence in the UN Security Council and its position as chair of the African Union Assembly of Heads of State and Government to strengthen cooperation between the UN and the AU. South Africa will need to do more, that is especially within the African Union High-Level Panel on Libya, to contribute to Libya's progress towards free, fair and credible presidential and parliamentary election in order to realize an African continent that is peaceful, democratic, united, prosperous, and which contributes to a world that is just and equitable. Honorable Chair, in terms of the bilateral relationship, Libya is widely known to have supported South Africans during the anti-apartheid struggle, including with military training in Libya. Formal diplomatic relations between South Africa and Libya were established in 1996. Subsequent diplomatic missions of both countries were opened in Tshwane and Tripoli, respectively. South Africa today has a structured bilateral mechanism with Libya called the Joint Bilateral Commission, the JBC, of 2001 at a ministerial level. Since the uprising in 2011, that was later backed by NATO under UN resolution, the JBC has not held a session. Due to security concerns, South Africa, like several other countries, has also closed its embassy in Tripoli. As Libyan authorities seek to find stability, they have made calls for countries to reopen their embassies for the resumption of bilateral relations. Following the ousting of the former President Gaddafi in the post-2011 environment, Libya has been struggling to establish democratic institutions. There has been a lack of government capacity to control militias who refuse to subject themselves to the rule of law under the government. Violence between rival militia, foreign troops, mercenaries, tribal and religious groups competing for control of certain territories and resources has deprived the government of the opportunity to move forward on establishing strong democratic institutions. Government institutions which are meant to unite during the political process towards democracy continue to undermine each other. And additionally, political leaders appear to put their comfort in privileged position above the need of ordinary Libyan citizens. Libya remains deeply divided and continue to suffer from a lack of unified political leadership. The East, which is UN-backed government of national unity, and the West, which is led by the General Khalifa Haftar and support base, recently portrayed a polarized geostrategic division and is still divided with elements of tribal clashes amongst different tribes and armed militias in Libya. Some members of the international community are similarly displaying unilateral interest of common approach by external actors has also become a glaring issue hindering the Libyan political process. There is a threat that if the situation in Libya continues to division between the Tripoli and Tripoli, they all ongoing political and security tension in the country has been the reason why the elections scheduled for 24 December 2021 did not take place. The interpretation of Libyan People's Dialogue Forum for 2021, which outlined that the mandate of the UN-backed government of national unity will expire on the 25th December 2022, anti-government of national unity groups led by General Haftar imposed a new prime minister, Fatih Bashagha. This move was endorsed by the parliament, effectively meaning that the country's two concurrent prime ministers, followed the refusal of the current government of national unity recognized prime minister to hand over power. Parliament has deemed the government of national unity mandate post 24 December 2021 as nullified and requested of its parliamentary committee to hold election within 14 months from its constitutional amendment. The Government of National Unity is, however, pursuing election as early as June 2022. And Prime Minister Alpha Al-Dabab, on the basis that election have not taken place, is refusing to step down and continue to receive the support of the UN and the West. He escaped assassination attempt in his life on the 9th of February 2022. The attempt on his life has led to an increased military presence in Tripoli. South Africa, therefore, Chair, stands ready to assist Libya and to share her experience in reconciliation, constitutional building process, and democratic transformation of the state. In the early days of post-Gaddafi Libya, South Africa, through the exchange of high-level delegation, offered to the National Transitional Council to share her experiences in transitional justice, transformation of the state, unification of statutory and non-statutory forces, as well as the development of the economy. As a member of the African Union High-Level Committee on Libya, chaired by the Republic of Congo, South Africa will continue to engage the various Libyan stakeholders to promote and undertake the dialogue. I thank you, Chair, and I request that the acting DG is given a space to, is allowed to introduce the presenter of our information this morning. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Comrade Deputy Minister. Over to you, Madam Nyan.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to the Deputy Minister as well. Honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, good morning. We have prepared a presentation, and firstly, let me appreciate the invitation, Honorable Chair, to allow the Department to share our views and analysis of what's happening in Libya, our fellow African country. So we have prepared a presentation, which will be delivered by our colleague, Mr. Fadl Nasruddin. He's the Chief Director responsible for North and Central Africa. And with your permission, Chair, Rev Fadl, please take the floor and take the committee through the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Acting DG Maniela, Deputy Minister, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee and colleagues. Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to engage in, I think, what is a very important discussion, because what is happening in Libya is of grave concern. And I would like to start off by noting that, as the chairperson said, Libya has been going through a very tough time. I would like to perhaps add to that to say that Libya is going through a very tough time, is continuing to experience a tough time. And by all indications, my conclusion at the end of the presentation would be that unless something very different occurs in the processes that we are discussing, Libya may in fact not only continue to have difficult times, but may in fact regress even further. So this is a very timely discussion, and I do thank the Portfolio Committee for inviting us to engage in this discussion. Chairperson, the presentation that is there on the screen, I'm going to ask that we just go to that outline, but not necessarily to the slides. The Deputy Minister, in her introductory remarks, have touched on many of these. So in the interest of time, I'm going to just pick out certain factors which I think I just want to add to the comprehensive framework that the Deputy Minister has laid out in the introductory remarks about what is happening in Libya and where we stand with regards to the ongoing situation. As we will recall, in 2011, when brother leader Gaddafi was deposed and killed, Libya was plunged into chaos, and as the saying goes, the center did not hold. And this essentially brought into play many layers within Libyan society, into conflicts and sub-conflicts that has made it very difficult for Libya to chart a way forward, both in terms of the formal processes of developing a constitution and maintaining law and order, essentially of establishing a post-conflict state in which the citizens can carry on with life and rebuilding and development aspects. This situation has deteriorated, but with the intervention of the international community at the multilateral level, has greatly assisted the situation within Libya, and most importantly, that was the bringing about of a ceasefire to the rivalry. Essentially, what has happened is Libya has been divided into two main competing geographic sectors, the one from the east and the one from the west. The western sector, if you wish, is led by the Government of National Unity, which is the UN-recognized authority that governs, that essentially should be governing Libya. And, of course, the opposition, which has broken away and has contested the legitimacy of the GNU, the Government of National Unity, has been General Haftar's forces in the east side. Now, what has complicated the already complex situation within Libya, which has tribal, ethnic, and linguistic and historical elements to the constantly shifting alliances, has been the fact that there are so many outside forces also that has played a significant role in the trajectory, not only of the conflict, but in possibly how the situation might eventually be resolved. This is mostly played out at the multilateral level, but we must also recognize that there has been significant bilateral interests that have played out in this conflict. At the multilateral level, the United Nations remains seized of the matter and actively engaged, and I'll come back to that a little later. Also at the multilateral level, the African Union remains seized of the matter, and I'll touch on that as well. However, at the bilateral level, the two sides have received military and other forms of support from specific countries. To mention a few examples, General Haftar's side received support from the from Egypt, a neighboring country, as well as the Emirates, whereas the Government of National Unity side was bolstered by Turkey and by Qatar and others. Again, adding to this complex situation is the role of mercenaries, and in particular, we can talk about the Wagner Group, which is a group known to be of Russian origin as mercenaries, acting essentially on the side of the Eastern Bloc, under General Haftar, in other words, through Egypt. So with these external players making the situation even worse, the path towards establishing government and governorship of Libya through parliament has been extremely difficult, as Deputy Minister pointed out. the Prime Minister just recently had an attempt on his life, and this was the second time this has happened, in fact. We now have an even worse situation that has evolved. So that is by way of just some background to the elements that I want to touch on. And these come from the sort of more global perspective that we wanted to start out with. And as we are seeing, this happens in the context of a situation where multilateralism is, as has been pointed out, under threat, but also that there's an increasing trend now of big power projection and geostrategic interests overriding the issues of sovereignty of countries, overriding issues of development, coexistence, etc., in the interest of not only border security but broader security for the regional and global powers. So this, I think, is an important context for us to look at the conflict that is happening there. And of course, for us in the African continent, this goes against the principles that we espouse about silencing the guns, about reducing conflicts and bringing about constitutional changes of government and peaceful resolution of conflicts, etc. So, Jefferson, what we have at the moment is at the AU level, and the last meeting that took place on 7th July 2019 was at the heads of state and government level. And this, through this meeting, the AU process, which takes place under the auspices of the AU High-Level Committee on Libya, which was established with Niger, Mauritania, the Republic of Congo, and South Africa as members. And this High-Level Committee, the HLC on Libya, was part of the AU Peace and Security Council, And the objectives that were laid out, I think, are very clear and specific, that there must be a ceasefire, that there must be agreement on how the international community would engage in supporting the peace process, and that an inter-Libyan dialogue is necessary with various components to bring about a governable state. And the three legs of that inter-Libyan dialogue would be on the economic, political, and military levels. And I think these are important elements that the African Union have put on the table as a credible way forward. But, of course, there are competing plans, both at the UN Security Council level and then, of course, by the two factions, the two main factions within Libya themselves. So South Africa's position is in support of the SADC position as well as the AU position on the way forward in Libya. And South Africa, therefore, wishes to emphasize the need for a political solution, a solution that would be inclusive and would bring about security and effectively deal with disruptive external influence on these processes that would allow Libyans to determine their fate and to determine their institutions and to elect their leaders. And South Africa stands ready to support that process. And therefore, South Africa works closely through the African Union to do that. Now, the situation as it has unfolded within Libya was that elections were to have taken place on 25th December which would have meant that the current prime minister's term would end on the 24th of December, that is last year in 2021. But the elections did not take place, and this was then delayed by a month to 24th of January. And again, the elections were not able to take place due to various reasons. One was obviously that the security situation for credible elections to be held was not there, but there was also debates about constitutionality and how this should take place, given that questions were now being raised as to whether the Prime Minister, Dbeibah, is now still legitimately in his post, and whether the administration that he runs, the interim administration, enjoys legitimacy. Since the elections that were supposed to have taken place would have now had the legitimacy of having had the voters in Libya elect their leaders. This has resulted now in a very difficult situation, because the January elections did not take place. And so, as I alluded to earlier, they are now within Libya also then. Two rival plans. The recognized prime minister of the GNU continues to enjoy the support of the United Nations with regards to him leading a process for elections to take place as soon as possible and to create the conditions for free and fair elections. He has noted that he would like to have in June of this year to have legislative elections, and then for the legislature to then usher in a process through which the other institutions of the state could be brought about, including then later also to have the constitution itself put to referendum. The rival faction, however, has, in light of the failure of the elections taking place in January, elected through Parliament, have their own Prime Minister put in place. And so this has meant that the Haftar faction has their own roadmap for elections to take place within the country, and they have put forward a rival Prime Minister Fatih Bashagha. Fatih Bashagha has now declared himself the Prime Minister, so we are facing a situation where Libya has two Prime Ministers, the one that's internationally recognized, saying that he will not step down and cannot step down because his mandate was, in fact, to usher in the process, and that the hiccups in the process, notwithstanding, he should be allowed and supported to organize credible elections. Again, this has brought about the kind of instability where the complex domestic factions, rivalries, tribal and ethnic differences play out. And the external influence in this must not be underestimated. And so we now have not only a stalemate, but rival ways in which Libya is proposing to go forward. This means that at the AU level, we have to revise how best to support the situation and who to work with, etc. And so to this end, on 6 February, His Excellency President Denis Sassou Nguesso of the Republic of Congo, who's the chairperson of the AU High Level Committee on Libya, expressed his concern on the failure of both parties to come to some kind of agreement and to hold the elections as was scheduled. And that this poses a risk for peace and stability, not only in the country, but for the region as a whole. He urged the Libyan parties to respect the decisions taken by the different international meetings on Libya and emphasize the need for the ceasefire to hold. I'm happy to report that the ceasefire is holding, although low-level skirmishes do continue. And, of course, there is a very, very concerning situation with regards to the point that the Deputy Minister also raised, namely this illicit trade in arms, the smuggling of people, narcotics, etc., which is, of course, also a major concern in Europe because Libya has become a main conduit for people who are transiting from our continent through to try and get into Europe through various means. And if one looks at the map, of course, one can see how close Libya is to Italy. And of course, also from Libya, people can go through Morocco to try and get through other means into Europe. And so people smuggling and gross violation of human rights, etc., is an issue of grave concern for South Africa and, of course, for the international community. But in terms of actual military conflict, that has at least for now still been observed, and we hope that this will continue in order for diplomacy and mediation to take place. So I'll end by talking about the UN process very quickly. The UN has taken in its last resolution a role, what we call a technical rollover, which gives a 3 months mandate for the UN support mission in Libya, UNSMO, to continue for another 3 months. But I think what's important to point out for the portfolio committee is that in their statements in support of the technical rollover, these statements show the great division that exists within the UN family on this issue. Almost all the members expressed their dismay that the UN Security Council was not able to find consensus in taking not only a firmer stance on what is happening in Libya, but by charting a more specific path that they could mandate. We should recall that the intervention in Libya was a Chapter 7 UN intervention, and to that extent, the members of the Security Council felt that the Council could have taken more firm steps, but divisions especially within the bigger powers on the Council meant that what essentially they did was just to say, whatever you have now, roll it over for another 3 months, rather than adding to the mandate and strengthening the mandate in order for the UN people who are on the ground and who are dealing with this to take a firmer position with regards to the UN's stewardship of the process. An important element of that is the UN Secretary General's Special Representative, Stephanie Williams, who has shown, I should say, good skill in being able to speak to the different factions and to be able to extract compromises from the various parties, which is why I think the ceasefire has managed to hold. Now, Stephanie Williams is an American diplomat, and as the council divisions now have come to light, this has, I think, made her job much more difficult. Because the faction that is generally recognized by the UN, the GNU, has now just recently come out and spoken out against her because in trying to find a way forward with these competing roadmaps and with having two prime ministers, as soon as she was dispatched by the Secretary General to go and intervene and mediate to find a common way forward to have elections as soon as possible, she had pronounced that she may consider a longer period for them to hold elections. And the GNU, of course, felt that what she should have done is underscore and give support fully to the GNU's position, which after all is meant to be the UN position. And as the UN Secretary General's representative, it seemed contradictory that she was not giving full support to that that position, but rather trying to bring in the other side, so to speak. And in that mediation effort, it meant that the GNU has now, in a sense, not only criticized her, but felt that they need to state categorically that she should be careful not to be taking sides. And they alluded to the fact that she is now biased and therefore siding with Haftar's faction. So, Chairperson, we are at a very critical juncture, if I can conclude on this, at a very critical juncture with regards to the future of Libya and the region itself. But as I hope in my presentation, I've also indicated, this is not just a domestic issue within one country, but also a conflation of great external interests. And therefore, the role of the African Union and South Africa is important in preserving the notion that we need to support constitutional changes of government, that we need to support constitutionalism and the idea of having free, fair, open elections that are inclusive and so forth. Those ideals that we cherish through the AU. And so, I my conclusion was, which I stated at the beginning, is that Libya is really in a very difficult, continues to be in a difficult situation and faces a potentially even worse situation. So we will continue to monitor, and I think we will need to continue to have this engagement as we look at the way forward and play a role through the AU for Africa to continue to play a more important and more firm role in supporting institution building, in supporting the country to have a maintenance of a ceasefire and to continue dialogue rather than to resort back to conflict. Thank you, Chairperson. I will hand back to Acting DG and in my presentation here. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, Mr. Fadel, how do you pronounce your surname?
Chairperson, it's Fadel, my first name. It's an Arabic name, Fadel and Nasiruddin.
Oh, Nasiruddin, okay. I didn't want to get it wrong. Thank you very much. Ndadumnyal.
Thank you, Chair. That was the presentation. Thank you very much for your indulgence.
Okay. No, thank you very much. I don't know, Deputy Minister, whether we've got the ambassador of Libya, South Africa ambassador in Libya, if he's on the platform. Deputy Minister? Ndadumnyal?
Chair, we don't have an ambassador posted in Libya at the moment.
But he's home, I think.
Yes.
Okay. But it could have been better for him to join the meeting, or is he reposted? from Libya to elsewhere, because it will be better to at least have the last person who was in Libya as the ambassador, as you have indicated that South Africa, because of the violent situation, had to temporarily close. Yes. I don't want to say close, temporarily close, or temporarily suspend its presence. Maybe we should say South Africa temporarily suspended its presence of operations through the embassy in Libya because of the security situation. So I was just saying it could have been better to have the last person who dealt with the situation through our office there to be present in the meeting. Well, because he's not here, you can do that for note.
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, no problem. Just before I give the honourable members opportunity to interact with the presentation, thank you very much for the comprehensive presentation, Deputy Minister, for such a comprehensive, very informative, incisive presentation, followed by Mr. Nazir. Thanks for that. I think it enlightens us a great deal about the situation there. Now, in the presentation, there's somewhere where you speak about the involvement of other countries like Egypt, Qatar, and so on, which are in that region there, and then supporting this group and that group in Libya. My question will be whether South Africa hasn't engaged those countries separately, whether it's Egypt, whether it's Qatar, to talk them separate from the formal processes that have been agreed to through the EU, but rather as because we have got diplomatic relations with them, to talk to them about them working with different groupings in Libya in a way that will help us achieve our strategic goal, which is the stabilization of the situation, intensification of democratic processes through elections, and so on. That's the first issue. The second one is on external influence. I think it will be better to mention those countries that may be involved in influencing the situation to get worse in Libya. If it's Italy, we must say it's Italy. So I will suggest that you mention the country so that we can check whether the same as what we are going to be doing with Qatar, Egypt, and other countries that seem to be supporting different strands there politically, whether through our diplomatic relations and other relations we have with other countries which we refer to as external forces, whether we can't engage those other countries on the Libyan situation and how their involvement in Libya should be such that it helps stabilize the situation. If there are companies that come from those particular countries and may be involved in extraction of value from Libya for their own narrow, selfish interests, we should be able to say what are those interests and how do those countries deal with their own companies that may be involved in worsening the situation in Libya. I think that will help so that South Africa can find a way of speaking to those different countries. That's the presentation, honorable members. We will now take hands from different members. We've got Honorable Hendricks, we've got Honorable Nkosi, We've got Honorable Skumbuzo Mpanza, the acting president of SANCO in the Republic of South Africa, in that order.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Honorable Chair, I was in Libya in 1974, and the 11 Revolutionary Council members representing the people of Libya were very passionate about bringing down apartheid in South Africa, and through the Palestinian branch in Libya, the process started to send weapons to South Africa via Angola so that we can speed up the downthrow of apartheid. So I'm very pleased to hear that the policy of the government will be to assist the people of Libya, because the people of Libya, when I was there, showed a lot of compassion and interest in South Africa. So I welcome this policy position. We're obviously not going to send arms to Libya, like I suggested previously, to Palestine and Western Sahara, but we will be offering reconciliation services and offering support to reduce the conflict, because we know it's more of a civil war in Libya. So I'm very happy with the approach that is being suggested to the Portfolio Committee, and I hope the Portfolio Committee will support it. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Honorable Hendricks. Thanks very much. Honorable Nkosi.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Deputy Minister Mashego. And the department. I just want to raise three issues. First, the first one is at a UN security level or in the UN, to what extent is South Africa actively lobbying for the resolution of the conflict in Libya? And what would be the attitudes and opinions of other important players, except in the Security Council, where at least we know. But what are the other members of the UN saying? Are they prioritizing the resolution of the conflict in Egypt? Or to what extent is this regarded as an issue that requires attention? Secondly, at the AU level, I think my observation is that to a very large extent, the solution to the problem in Libya is externally driven. I mean, to the extent that we see active participation by non-Libyans, the conflict would be held in Italy, UAE, etc. I don't have a sense that the AU is actively involved in trying to resolve the problem. What are the subjective issues, for example, that prevents the AU from taking an active and secondly, are there constraints in the AU itself? What are these constraints? Do they have to do with the geopolitical situation and or are countries or members of the AU concentrating on their own internal situations and therefore neglecting or not paying attention to the resolution of the problem in Libya? The third and last issue today is around the geopolitics in the Maghreb region, but broadly in the Arabic world. To what extent are these playing a part in stalling and or propelling the movement towards creating peace in Libya, and thus allowing for a stable and sustainable government based on democratic values adopted by the UN, AU. Maybe lastly, I don't think that from the presentation one gets a sense that we are actively involved as a country in ensuring that there is security. I think what we're looking at is post democratic process mechanisms, you know, to bring about unity, reconciliation, et cetera, et cetera. What is our active role? If you observe prior to 2011, and perhaps it was because we were part of the UN as a Security Council, but prior to that, I mean, we seemed to be an active participant in that problem, in that conflict. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nkosi. Ndade Mpanza.
No, good morning, Chair, and thanks very much for that opening remarks that you have made. And also, sorry for what happened to your iPad.
I really
sympathize with you, Chair. I was once a victim of a similar incident myself. so I know how it feels. No, Chair, let me thank the Deputy Minister, Honorable Mashego Dlamini, and also the Acting DG, and the Chief Director, who did the presentation on behalf of the department. No, Chair, I think this is a very useful exercise that you have allowed the portfolio committee to engage on, taking into account what Honorable Hendricks has said in terms of the struggle credentials and the progressive nature of Libya as a country and its involvement in trying to make sure that there is freedom and liberty in the countries of the world. So it's a very important country in the world politics. And what is happening there is really disturbing, Chair, as everyone who has been making the presentation, including the remarks by the Deputy Minister, were alluding to that fact, and it's something that we cannot take lightly. And in line with what Honorable Ngosi is saying, I would appeal that maybe we see more active participants and engagement of South Africa as a country in assisting in resolving the conflict of the Libyan people. I also had the same concern that it seems as if South Africa is just a passive, not an active, passive participant in what is happening there in Libya. But, Chair, what I also wanted to propose is that because these presentations are very much important, since you have recommended that we have them from time to time to understand what is happening in other parts of Africa and the world over, that our presenters
maybe it will be important for us just for broadening our knowledge of a particular country, even if the presentation will be dealing with the current dynamics, but just to get a history of the country and what political policies it was advancing and the agenda, whether the country was once colonized and what was their struggles leading up to them being liberated from the colonial masters. And then something like that, sort of a form of umhabulo, Chairperson, for us as a committee, and then deal with the matter at hand. But I think that background information would assist, because we can't take it for granted that all of us, we understand the struggles that Libya went through before 2011, which led to the brother leader, Muammar Gaddafi, which we know what agenda was he pushing in terms of positioning Africa as a force to be reckoned in international politics, which maybe some of us might think that even his deposition and eventually his ultimate killing might be a link to what he was advancing for Africa as a continent. But I think it's important that we get that background information in every presentations that we'll get maybe going forward. I want to propose that the presentation they also cover the aspects. My apologies, Chair. I just want to deal with this call. And the Chair, also fully agree with you that let's get those countries, external forces mentioned. Because it's not only countries, as you have correctly pointed out, Chairperson. You also have private securities in those countries. Sometimes they go there without the mandate or the authority of the country that they are coming from, because of their economic interest, and then they go there and participate in destabilizing a country in order for them to extract things for value, as we have said. And then you have mercenaries also who come there, the bandits and all those things. So it's important that we also get information so that, as we have correctly said, then we will, you know, at the side and behind the scenes, be in a position as a country to engage with those countries, and also to make them aware of what is happening if there are mercenaries and bandits and private securities that are coming from their countries, who might not be acting in the best interest of their countries as well, so that you will then deal with the issue of all the participants there in a more comprehensive manner than dealing with it on a haphazard and isolated manner, which might not contribute in making sure that we get the lasting solution to the conflict. Thanks very much, Chairperson.
Thanks, Honorable Mpanza. Ntate Faba.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, Chairperson, I just want to go to something a little bit else, but I do believe that that might have an influence with relationships. And I wanted to know, and it all began that time in the Arab Spring and the fall of Gaddafi in 2011. And there was a stage that President Zuma and our then Minister of Finance went to General Gaddafi, and this was a BBC documentary. where an amount of $12 billion were apparently sent to South Africa. And I know that the Libyan government at that stage, or actually not long, a year or two ago, after that documentary, actually asked for the return of this money. Now, I also know there was an amount paid back by then Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan. And I would like to know if our presenter can maybe enlighten us on this situation, that we also know what our relationships are with the now government in Libya, that we understand that. Because, I mean, obviously, if the Libyan government at this stage want the money back, or what is the situation on this? Is it still a burning issue? Or is it secretive? Or what is the situation? Do we know anything on this? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Faba. Earlier on, I was supposed to also include a request in the response to include how we, as South Africa, working with friends within the AU and elsewhere, are we finding other ways of working with different groupings, whether they are religious, whether they are political and otherwise, a way of working with them such that they can understand the importance of the long-term stability benefits for the people of Libya, for the African continent, and the world? Because I think if we can do that, if we speak to the religious organizations through the higher leadership from elsewhere, including all over the world, to talk to them, that can help in bringing in an important political variable in the equation of bringing stability into Libya. If it has been done, congratulations. If it's not been done, I will suggest that we try and invest a lot of energy, a lot of resources in we have identified them, in saying each grouping, now that we have characterized them, now that we have identified them, where else can we get help to try and talk to them, even if it's outside the formal processes, so that we can know deeper what are the underlying reasons from such groupings for them to cooperate in bringing about peace in Libya? Because if we don't do this, if we don't do involvement and engagement of society at different levels on the ground, you can have elections, but the elections will not bring peace. The possibility is very high that after the elections, there'll be new problems. It will be like a revolving door. But if we invest in talking to people's organizations on the ground, talking to their leadership, talking to the people themselves, getting other countries within the AU and elsewhere to help us to talk to such people, engage these imperialists who are pushing an agenda of economic anarchy in Libya, and show them that they are causing destruction in Libya by putting their interests first, which are economic, at the expense of the Libyan people and the African continent. We have to engage them because we have relations with them. These are external forces which you are going to mention. There's no way Italy, for instance, will not be part of the problems in Libya. So because of South Africa, we've got relations with Italy. We must sit down with the Italians and say, but why are you continuing to participate in the situation in Libya in the manner in which you are doing? So that we can find a way of, as I say, having external positive influence rather than external negative and disruptive influence. Over to you, Comrade Deputy Minister, and your team.
Well, thank you very much. We'll like the presenter to start to respond if there's any that you want to raise. Thank you. Our presenter, Chair, to respond on certain issues, I will come later.
Yes. Yes. We are waiting for the presenter to start with the responses.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Deputy Minister. Chairperson, through you, I'd like to thank the committee members, the honourable members, for the questions and some of the suggestions and comments made. I think they are very valid, and I think this is one of the benefits of having this kind of dialogue and exchange of views. I'll try and respond to as best I can to some of the questions. There were some that were quite extensive. But to start with yourself, Chair, and the issue of the countries that are engaged in this process, the so-called external players that have been involved. With regards to the so-called mercenary factor, I refer to the Wagner Group. Now, there are many other players who are also acting as mercenaries, but in the Wagner Group in particular, I think is something perhaps that at a different time should be something of a subject of discussion, because the Wagner Group is not only involved in Libya, but in many other theaters of conflict, including on our continent in Mozambique, Madagascar, Sudan, Central African Republic, Mali. So one sees quite active engagement by a group that supports military action in conflict theaters, and perhaps we need to have a more closed engagement where we can discuss the concerns around some of that kind of activity. But at least for our purposes, that's one group that we have mentioned as an external player. But others that have also had active fighters on the ground engaging and participating in the military conflict have come from countries like Chad, Mali, and Sudan. And so, again, who they represent or whether they are there as paid participants from some of the other bigger powers, I don't know. Chair, if I may just interrupt myself, I see that the Honourable Faber has his hand on and up. I don't know if he wishes to interrupt with a question or comment. May I ask?
Excuse me, Chairperson. Sorry, Chair. I just put it down.
Okay. No problem. Thank you, Chair. So I'll continue. That was with regards to those who are actively putting so-called boots on the ground and getting involved. But then there are countries that are supplying weapons, but not actually putting boots on the ground, but financing and so on. And to this extent, the Haftar faction was very actively supported on the one hand with Egypt being the main supporter literally across the border. And of course, the UAE or the Emirates playing a part also in providing finance and weapons to the Haftar faction. On the other side, in fact, when the Haftar faction received this kind of support, they launched a large offensive to take over the capital, Tripoli. And through the intervention of Turkey, who not only put boots on the ground, but actual much more sophisticated defense systems, etc., they were able to not only push back the Haftar faction, but to bring about the conditions that have helped to have a ceasefire. Because if Turkey was allowed to continue, there would have been a much more large-scale conflict, a proxy conflict between those who are supporting the Haftar faction, namely Egypt and the UAE, and on the one hand, and Turkey and Morocco and others on the other hand. And so the avoidance of a proxy war taking place in Libya brought about a stalemate between the two sides, and I think was, in our analysis, a contributing factor to therefore bringing about the ceasefire and bringing the parties to the table. I think members were correct to point out that the dialogue has been quite largely externally driven, and South Africa has been very vocal in stating that ultimately international community can help, can support, but that the dialogue must be between Libyans, and that the negotiations of a final outcome, which will necessarily require, as we know from our own situation, our own history, will require some difficult compromises on both sides, or all sides, I should say. That necessarily means that the Libyans will have to do that internally amongst themselves with the support of the international community rather than the interference of the international community. So members are correct to say that the process currently is more externally driven, and that is because the situation of bringing Libyans to talk to each other needs to be created. And one of the important factors of the external role, for example, from the UN, is to ensure that the ceasefire holds. And we certainly hope that this will continue and that there won't be an outbreak of full-scale armed conflict again. And so the role of the UN is important in that. But the African Union recognizes that it needs to play a greater role. And I must add here that South Africa is not a passive observer in this instance. But of course, South Africa respects the channels through which we engage. We engage at the multilateral level, at the UN, including through the UN Security Council, by engaging with the members who are on the council, actively looking at the positions, the resolutions that are adopted, etc., and working with the delegations that represent Africa as elected members of the UN Security Council. So South Africa is actively engaged in the UN context. But South Africa is also a member, as I mentioned in my presentation, of the high-level panel of the AU, and through the Peace and Security Council, South Africa actively keeps the issue on the agenda and pushes for the AU to have great involvement and a greater say in the processes that are unfolding, especially with regards to the fact that some of the members that I mentioned who are external players, such as Egypt, is a member of the high-level panel. And so to answer the question from one of the members also, yes, South Africa is engaging with those members then at that multilateral level, but also at a bilateral level. Bilaterally, we do raise our concerns. We do lobby for members, both at the, for instance, the EU level, engagements with other countries bilaterally, to lobby them to support a process that will lead to the elections and to, rather than fuel the conflict through military engagement, to support a process that will lead to negotiations, to the adoption of a constitution, and to setting up a viable functioning state. But of course, one of the members correctly pointed out there are interests involved, and this makes it a very difficult dialogue because there are countries, especially in the southern parts of Europe, that are concerned about the migration problem of people trying to get into Europe. This is a huge problem for them, and so they have an interest in stability and peace and security mainly. Others have an interest in the oil sector. Libya is a country with large reserves of petroleum. And so protecting that and allowing the companies that have facilities there to continue to do so and to have the security to continue to do that is an important interest of some of the bigger powers. But I've also mentioned, and I very consciously noted this, because as we speak, we are facing a situation in Ukraine that I think starkly reminds us of the fact that at one point many years ago, when we were looking at South African foreign policy, we spoke about South Africa in the midst of a bipolar world, where there were two superpowers. And then there was the diffusion into a multipolar world where there were several other powers and regional, and power became more regionally decentralized. And then we ended up with what became essentially the U.S. as a sole global superpower. And this is now playing out again, where the tensions to have projections of power globally in various geostrategic areas, whether it's the South China Sea, whether it's the Pacific, whether it's in the Baltic area, and so forth. We see this playing out, and Ukraine is the current flashpoint for that. When NATO extended its mandate, and I'm mentioning Ukraine because NATO is obviously one of the key issues for Russia in the Ukraine situation, but Libya, in some small sense, was a precursor to this whole idea that NATO intervenes under international mandate in a country in stark contrast to the understanding that NATO was purely a defensive mechanism for European countries, and how it is, it was seen to be increasingly extending essentially its role, and intervened then in Libya in bringing down the administration or the rule of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. And this has left the rest of the world with a messy threat to peace and security, and the situation in a country that has now descended into what we described earlier. So Russia's role, Russia being then one of the parties to the situation, supporting the Haftar faction as opposed to the one that is supported by the UN and the UN Security Council. So it becomes clearer to see that the council is not at one, and this unfortunately would send a very wrong signal to the internal players that the international communities in this area, and therefore may give them space to create conditions on the ground, which we would rather not see. So Saudi Arabia is another country I can mention that is supportive of the Haftar faction. France is an active supporter of the Haftar faction. I've mentioned Sudan and Chad, who have active fighters on the ground, but also Niger, and I've mentioned the UAE. So these are countries that have directly played a role. But of course, we also know at the UN level, for instance, the EU plays a role in having a broader position of its own, especially with regards to issues like migration and so forth. Let me just see if I can get onto some of the other. The question of history, Chairperson, I fully agree with the member. History is very important in all of this. And if we listen to President Putin's speech yesterday, we know that when we want to understand things, history is important, but also our interpretation of history. And unfortunately, in these briefings, we always know that time is our enemy. We try and give background without going into too much detail in history, but of course we will always be guided by what the committee members need, and if there's a need to maybe spend at some other more opportune time to provide either a briefing on history, some of the history, or to provide maybe in writing before the presentation documentation that summarizes perhaps some of the key points that are of historical significance to the current situation. We are quite willing to do that. What we did in this circumstance was really to just try and mention some of the contextual aspects of that. With regards to the question on the Arab Spring and the money that was mentioned, we do not have information about that, and I really not in a position to deal with that question, because I honestly don't have much more information than I think the member, the honourable member, already has. But our ambassador, and I want to clarify this, with acting DDG Maniela said we don't have an ambassador there. That's correct. We withdrew due to the peace and security situation in the country. Our ambassador, who is in Tunisia, Ambassador Masangu, covers Libya from Tunisia. He is currently not available. We have asked that our colleague, who is acting in the embassy in Tunisia, to see if he can join us. I'm not sure if he has. Chairperson, maybe he can announce himself if he has joined us, so that maybe he can also give some feedback as requested by the members. Mr. Mate, if you are with us, please let the chairperson know. Are we working with other parties, chairperson? To the extent that we can, we've worked with governments primarily on this, and not with NGOs or other parties. On the one hand, because it is not easy, there are not many parties engaged other than those who are doing humanitarian work. And of course, where we can, we would want to support some of the humanitarian work that they're doing. But at the political level, no, because we want to support the parties themselves. As I've mentioned in my presentation, our focus is on the various factions, political parties, etc. Now, I think it's a good point that was made, and I think it's something that we take note of, Chairperson, that perhaps there are other formations that can be helpful, religious leaders, other civic leaders, and to the extent that this may be possible, I think it's something that we will explore further and look into, and perhaps at the next time, if we have made any inroads on that, we can report on that as well. Chairperson, I hope I have broadly covered everybody, but I apologize if I haven't. I know time is always an issue, but that's you. If I haven't, please feel free to remind me to address any issues that I may have missed. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Farad. You've really responded accordingly to the matters. I see the
substance.
I see there is Ntate. Is it Ntate Madi?
Yes, I'm here. I'm here, Chair.
Like,
Yes.
Lega.
Ntenkai.
Siabonga. You are in Tunisia.
Yes, I'm in Tunisia. The net here, it's down and it gets interrupted, but I can hear you, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, did you follow the discussions?
I came in late. It was sent a little bit, so it was a time when members were in questions.
Basically, what we are dealing with here today is the unfolding political situation in Libya.
Yes.
And the role that South Africa, through the Department of International Relations and Cooperation and other means, is playing through the AU, through bilaterals, and through multilateral organizations to try and deal with the situation in Libya. So we thought that if about 5 to 10 minutes is given to somebody who was the last person or who is currently dealing with to deal with Libyan situation, as you are based now in Tunisia, but you're also putting your other eye on the Libyan situation. So we thought that we could give you about 5 to 10 minutes from your perspective. I'm sure you have listened to Deputy Minister Masiho.
Yes.
And I'm sure you, but I'm sure you heard the presentation by Ntate, is it Farah?
Nasreddin, I also met that part. I only joined when some members were asking the question and when.
Okay. But anyway, over to you for 5 minutes or so. You can cover a little bit that you know about the situation in Libya and how we are dealing with it.
Oh yes, thank you very much, Honorable Chair. We are here in Tunisia following the developments on a daily basis of what is happening in Libya. So we prepared the presentation that is being presented currently to the committee. We did give a synopsis of the background. And then what are the challenging matters? We talked to the issues of mercenaries. We also spoke about why the reasons the elections could not take place, the internal actors who had been supporting the East, who had been supporting the West, Haftar, the General National Union, the issue now with the two prime ministers. We have got the Prime Minister, Mr. Bashagha, the former Interior Minister, and then we also have Dibaiba, which makes the situation on the ground very difficult because you still have mercenaries, militias, and everybody there. In the situation, it's very difficult to deal with because of the external actors and then militia that are still there have not left. So the situation on the ground it's very difficult. We have been following all these developments and reporting on a weekly basis to the business unit. So we keep on updating the business unit with weekly reports of the development because we are following them on a daily basis.
Okay. Thank you very much, for that briefing and for preparing the report.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you very much for that. I don't know, Deputy Minister, if there's something you want to say as we wrap up.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson, and also thank the members that have asked clarity questions. Well, I think the officials have covered a lot, but it's safe to say, Chair, that I think in all what we're doing as a country, South Africa, we respect the individual country's sovereignty. And all what we are doing, especially the lobbying that we are doing to the stakeholders in Libya, we respect that at the end of the day is the Libyan themselves that need to take a decision. So we have got no right to push our ideas accordingly because our relations definitely is a mutual one. So I think members can really agree on that. Of course, on the issue of the private security companies that can really be hired to stabilize in one way or another in any country coming from South Africa, we don't have that information, but we'll check because this is a business country to country business relations. So we'll check because what we discovered that in Mozambique, there was a company that is coming from South Africa, security company hired there, but it was not hired through government of South Africa, but as a private company, they've got a right to trade wherever, but they've got no right really to make sure that in whatever they are doing, they let our foreign policy down. So these are some of the issues that you need to look at. On the issue of the money, we'll follow this thing up because we never really look at it in that sense because it was an issue that was discussed at that time, but we'll follow it up. And also agree with Honorable Mbanza on the proposal that you need to give a history. My take is that let's send the background information about the country so that when we present, members will have a preview of the background and the history of the country and also get into the real information that is needed by the committee. So thank you very much, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Minister, and I want to thank the collective within the department for the presentation. I think it is very useful, it's insightful, helping us to understand the situation better in Libya from the perspective of oversight. As a committee, it is our hope and it is our trust that we have in DERCO that you will continue to intensify all the means possible through diplomacy to achieve the strategic goal of a peaceful Libya, a stable Libya, a democratic Libya, which will also be embraced by other nations that appear to. Because at the end of the day is the people who suffer in Libya. So thank you very much for providing leadership in that regard, Honorable Mashiro. Honorable members, there's a matter relating to our retreat. I will give Lubabalo just an opportunity to indicate to us the dates and whether if we are fine with those particular dates, because the problem is the dates are overlapping into the weekend. Lubabalo?
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson and honorable members, we have two sets of dates that we have identified. The first set is on the 18th of March, 19th and 20th of March, which is on a Friday to a Sunday. And another set of dates will be the 19th, 2021 of April, which is from Tuesday to Thursday. So those are the questions that we requested to give us guidance on which set will be more convenient so that we can start preparing for the logistics. Thank you, Chair.
Fine. Give those again in March. Is which
the first set is the 18th, which is on a Friday, 19 and 20, Chair. And then the second set is the 19, 20, 21 of April.
Okay. There's the dates. Which ones are we comfortable with? It is during the week and during the weekend.
Chair, I've raised my hand, but maybe you don't see it that side.
Yes, I'm going to. I can see it now. Yeah, you can proceed, Honorable Mpanza.
No, Chair, I just wanted to ask a clarity question. Is none of these dates, whether encroaching the weekend or only the weekdays, none of them are not coinciding with the calendar of Parliament in terms of leave or constituency days? I'm just wanting to check that one, yeah, Chair. Thanks.
No problem. Honorable Faba.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, Chairperson, as I am only an alternate on this committee, I would just like to also ask that maybe I can, to cut costs, maybe just go to the DIRCO leg of this, and then obviously let the rest of the committee go to the further oversight.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, the first set, which
just
is...
Just hold on, yes, Honorable Chetty. Honorable Chetty.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I want to agree with what the Honorable Panza has said, whereby we make sure we try to keep it in line with Parliament's program as well as constituency period. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. How's Dinel?
Thank you very much, Honorable Person, Chairperson. I just to give more clarity to what Lubabalo is saying, these are dates for the committee to consider its own strategic plan and the annual plan, the annual performance plan and the strategic plan. It's not the oversight. So the set in April, it will be during the oversight week for Parliament. So it will give members enough time, because it's during the week, it's Tuesday to Thursday. It will give members enough time to consider the strategic plan. And then the first one in March is because of parliamentary program that members will only have Friday, Saturday to work. Otherwise, if members prefer the one in March, then it means they will have a they will have to also consider working over the weekend, whereas the one in April, it will be during oversight period for Parliament. Thank you, Chairperson. I thought I should just explain that.
Okay. Okay. Honorable Mpanza?
No, Chair, thanks very much. Based on the explanation, I would propose, Chair, that it's preferable, even if it's not coinciding with the oversight, but it's always preferable to use the weekdays than using the weekends, because I think, if I'm not talking for everyone, but weekends also have got other responsibilities, which are either family commitments or personal commitments that are not related to our parliamentary work. So for me, I would propose that maybe we look at the weekdays, and it's more favorable that anyway, as for a parliamentary program, is oversight. So it fits very well with the parliamentary work, and it's not conflicting. Thanks, Chair.
Now, if I'm not wrong, it was our plan to have that visit or oversight to Pretoria, to the department, during that week of oversight. Or Lubavalo.
Thank you, Chair.
Because it means if we... My understanding is that if we use those days, it means we'll be forfeiting the oversight that we're supposed to do to DERCO.
No, Chairperson, they are not clashing at all. Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, the dates are not clashing, Chair. If Omri members prefer April, it should be after the committee has returned from Namibia, Chair. And if members prefer March, still the strength plan will be in the week before we go to Pretoria, Chairperson. The dates are not clashing at all.
If you are not clashing, then it's fine. Honorable Faba.
Sorry, Chair, just before I end down again.
Okay, Honorable Chetty.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Chair, I just want to find out if this is going to be the step plan that we are talking about. Isn't April too late? Isn't there any other dates available during March? Just a question I'm raising. In a sense that surely it might be more beneficial for us to meet as a committee before we even do our oversight to Namibia. I'm not sure what your take on it, Chairperson. Thank you.
Okay. Tatemwela.
Kalebuga Chairperson, kidumelise maluka a hlompelego a parliament. Chair, I want to agree with honorable members, in particular honorable Mpanza, that let's take the weekdays rather than taking weekends. That was my contribution, Chair, in supporting honorable acting president.
Okay, March is ending next week. So it basically means we are agreeing that we will go on those days of April. So that is how we conclude it.
Apologies.
Yes.
We are still in February. And you said March is ending next week.
Sorry. My mind is too ahead.
My apologies, Salo. That's the reason why I was asking whether we're going to consider dates in March as opposed to as late as in April, because we still got a month more. So that's why my suggestion was coming in. And I can see where you had a misunderstanding when you thought we're already in the end of March, so you thought it's next week. So that's why I was trying to have the meeting before we go to Namibia so that we can all be on the same page. Thank you, Chair.
No, I get your point. Why don't we then agree that we mandate the chair in his office to go and look for a suitable date in March, failing which we stick to April? Honorable Mpanza?
Yes, Chair, I think we can agree on that one with the proviso that, but even if it's in March, but it doesn't include weekends.
Yes, the weekends are out completely. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
The weekends are
so support.
I also support the proposal of the chair.
Yeah, Honorable Ngola.
Yes, chair.
We have whom?
Yes, chair. I support the proposal that you have just presented. That you, the chair, leads the process of looking for suitable dates. If it is completely impossible to get some dates in March, then we can move to April.
Okay. Ntate Mpanza, is this an earlier hand?
Yes, okay. Chair, no, sorry. It's the Lakers hand.
Okay. Good luck, honorable members, for your ears and eyes are going to be getting the details about how what has been collected throughout the country is going to be distributed. And you can't change anything, so we must go and listen. And thereafter, make sure that we do the necessary oversight on whatever would have been allocated to what do we need to do to deliver services to the people. The petrol is now going above 20 rand. So we need for things in a way that does not push us into the pit in as far as budget process as individuals is concerned. I wish you luck, honorable members, and this is how we come to the end of our meeting. Baya danki, kya leboga, siyabulela, hambani kahle.
Siyabonga, Chair.
Siyabonga, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Have a good day. Thanks to the chairs.
Siyabonga, slalo.
Thank you, Chair.
Sure.